Greetings to all of God's people. This is again Mordecai Joseph. We're today in lesson 237. And let's start again from chapter 23 of Exodus in verse 1. You shall not utter a false report, but, in other words, don't bear false witness. Put not your hand with the wicked to be an unrighteous witness. In other words, don't be any party to it. And obviously we live in a world where this is very common. And that was very common among people, and therefore this is one of the law that makes God's people holy, separate, apart, unlike the others. Verse 2, you shall not follow a multitude to do evil, neither shall you bear witness in a cause to turn aside after a multitude to pervert justice. In other words, do not follow the rule of the mob. Don't think that because the majority say that, believe that, understand that, and that's what they feel about this person or that thing or whatever it may be, that, well, they must know what they are doing, you know, they are right. He says, don't follow that. And it doesn't make any difference, you know, there may be the high and the mighty and the wise and all that. That has nothing to do with the truth. You see? In other words, you're going to have to, now and then, in life, stand in the middle and go against the stream. And that is extremely difficult, because most people just look, you know, like to accommodate others, and especially when there are people who are wiser. And they would say to themselves, well, surely they know what they're doing. You know, well, what do I know? You see? But God commands us, in essence, to be a committee of one. Whatever comes out of your mouth, you better make sure that it is truth. And doesn't make any difference who said it. And these are a part of the laws of judgment. You see? And the judges among God's people, and especially for us, who are going to be judges not only in this life, but in the life to come, we have to learn, you know, the rule of thumbs of judgment. It doesn't make any difference who said it, you see. It doesn't make any difference what we heard. It doesn't make any difference what we saw. That has nothing to do with the truth, because all those things can deceive us. As you can read in Isaiah 11, that even when God himself, when he comes down to this earth, the one that came down 2,000 years ago and will come again, when he sits on his throne to judge all nations, we read there very plainly, he's not going to judge according to the eyesight, you know, according to his sight, or according to his hearing. Because these are not the rules of thumb for judgment. And yet this is exactly what all of us are doing. So we say, well, you know, the majority say that, they certainly know what they are doing. Or the wise and mighty and high and whatever it may be, you know, people who are honorable, I have no doubt about them. Well, they said that, therefore it must be true. And God says, no, it doesn't work like that. And obviously people don't function that way. And, you know, people who study the law of God in the entirety of it, they realize you cannot rely on anybody, because whatever judgment proceeds out of our mouth, even if we haven't said anything about it, we just thought it because people said that, and then we begin to have certain feelings about certain people, and those guys may not even know about it, and we are hurting our relationship, and the whole thing may be based on false witness. It may not be an intentional one. Maybe based on the fact that others have done the same thing. You know, they just relied on a report, on a hearing, on the eyesight, and they pass it on, and you think, well, they certainly know what they're doing. And God says, don't do it. It doesn't make any difference under what circumstance. Don't do it. Do not follow multitude. Follow righteousness. And that's what he said about Christ. He's not going to judge according to the eyesight or the hearing, but in judgment, that is, in that judgment that he passes, he's going to do it in righteousness. And that's a major difference. A lot of people nowadays, you know, who are paying the penalty for the wickedness of others. And some people have been put to death, you know, on death row because of false report. You see? And we have to be very certain about it. So God says, don't do that. And, you know, we can spend hours just studying this law here and realize how many ramifications it has and how many ways you can apply it. In our days, that's not an old law, that's not something for the past, that's not an Old Testament, you see. This is a living thing, and all of us are guilty of it, to one degree or the other, you see, when we pass judgment, you know, snap judgment, and we don't know, and we haven't been there, and we don't know the heart of the person. It just, you know, there is an appearance there, but you cannot judge based on appearance. And so, you know, let's meditate on it as David would do, you know, day and night, to really comprehend what is really behind this mind of God and this law that he gave us, which is a reflection of his nature and mind and character. You see, and it's extremely deep, very deep. And so this is what he tells us here, verse 3, neither shall you favor a poor man in his cause. And that's again, that's not according, that's according to your sight. You know, well, he looks like a poor man, you know, and doesn't have much money. And you know, that rich man, you know, he certainly must be evil, must be wicked. He's just trying to grab something out of the poor. And the poor man must be speaking the truth. You see? Then again, God says, don't even think that way. It has nothing to do with the poor or rich. It has nothing to do with any of those things. Righteousness must be based, you see, on righteous facts. And you cannot know that unless you totally go into the process of digging very deeply into it, searching, finding out, and only then you can pass judgment. So the judges are not people who are just quick to make a snap decision. They have to be extremely sober. That's why God said, you know, when you choose judges to be over you, they must be the kind of people who fear God. You see, this is what's going to guide them. And they are the ones who are also hating bribes. They don't want to be prejudiced by anybody. And a lot of people are not that way. Most of us are not that way. We're prejudiced so easily. Well, he's a poor man, or he's a good man. He certainly wouldn't do that. You know, he couldn't hurt a fly. He certainly wouldn't do a thing like that. He said it has nothing to do with that. And God is teaching us how to be judges. And this is, you know, this judgment that he gave to Moses to give us are extremely important in the making of the future judge and a priest in his kingdom. So we have to study that day and night and consider that and discuss it among ourselves and spend hours discussing it until we see every possible way there to avoid if it is unrighteous, and so it becomes second nature to us. That's how Christ is being formed in us, and that's what he means. Unless you eat my flesh and drink my blood, you will have no life, that is eternal life, in you. Because he's not interested in unjust judges in his kingdom. You see? And so this is what he's giving Israel here, to make them a holy people, the priests of all humanity. And they are going to fulfill this responsibility in the future, because that's exactly what God told them in the prophets. He's going to bring them back to the land and purge and cleanse and purify them and put his spirit in them and write his laws in their hearts. And he's going to use the foreigners to become their farmers, their shepherds, the builders of their walls, you see, and their houses, whatever it may be. He said, but you shall be the priests, you see, of your God. And this is the future of even physical Israel, not just a spiritual one. And so obviously the law of God is extremely important, and that's what the new covenant is all about. You know, some people think, well, I'm under the new covenant, New Testament. I don't need the Old Testament, you know, I don't need all those laws, it's all done away with. That's utter idiocy if we have this notion. That's totally insanity on the part of people. Verse 5, God says, verse 4 actually, if you meet your enemy's ox or his ass going astray, you shall surely bring it back to him again. Now, again, mind you, what are we talking about? What's the context of this whole law? That's a family affair. You see, it's within the community. It's within the family. And all your, you know, brothers and sisters, they have children, you see, and they have, the whole family, they have uncles and cousins and nephews and nieces, you see. And these are the people around you in your village, in your town, in your community. They're not foreigners. So your enemy is one of your, you know, family members. May not be the immediate one. You see, maybe your cousin, your nephew, you know, your niece, you know, somebody you don't like because of this or that or the other thing. That's your enemy. You see, that's what the law is all about. Love your beloved friend. You know, as we said earlier, it's not your neighbor. It's your friend. See, it's a part of your family. Love him as you love yourself. And so if you see somebody who is in that state of mind because of whatever reason he is your enemy, help him. In other words, don't say, well, who cares? I don't care about him. In other words, don't let your emotions govern your mind. Let the mind, you know, where the heart, the mind and heart are basically the same. It's just a matter of the intellect and then the emotions. But let that be governed by the law of God, by the nature of God. So regardless of how you feel about it, do it. Do that which is right, no matter what. That's what he's teaching them. He's trying to, in essence, of course, he did not succeed because of their own wickedness and their own faithlessness. But he's trying to convert them, to change their nature, to begin to think like he does. And the few that responded, obviously, they were more righteous than the others. And so that's the same thing with us. We have to learn that. And we walk down the road and we see somebody that has a little difficulty and we say, well, you know, I don't care about that, you know, that person. And of course, in our days, we don't have families all around us. extended family, so, you know, we have neighbors. But nevertheless, doesn't make any difference, as Christ made it very plain, you know, with a good Samaritan. It doesn't make any difference when the lawyer asked Jesus Christ, well, who is my neighbor? And he didn't ask that because the command was not love your neighbor as yourself, but love your friend. So he said, well, who is my friend? You know, we live in a society nowadays that we are not in a family environment anymore. We're in the cities, and we've got all these Gentiles living in our midst also. And so God gave him an example of the Samaritan. But he says, it doesn't make any difference. A human being, that's got to be your friend, because we are all children of the same Father. And so if we encounter matters like that, we should not rely on our feelings, how we feel about that person, and based on that we help or we don't help. You know, we should bridle our feelings, which are not right to begin with, you see, and help whenever there is a need to be helped. Because what are you going to accomplish by that? Let's find out. So he says, if you see, in other words, if you meet your enemy's ox, against in verse 4, or his ass going astray, you shall surely bring it back to him again. And if you see the ass of him that hates you, you see, you may not hate him, but he hates you, lying under its burden, you shall forbear to pass by him. In other words, don't say, well, who cares? He hates me, I'm not going to help him. He says, don't do that. You shall surely release it with him. In other words, help him, you know, with the burden of a donkey. So what's going to happen at this point? This is what you read in the Proverbs. You know, when somebody does you wrong, well, doing good, because in doing so, you're going to heap, you know, sort of a bucket or a pile of coals over his head. In other words, he's going to feel so bad about it, that here it is, he hates you, whether he has a cause or not, and you turn around and you commit an act of kindness and of love toward him. Well, that diffuses all the hatred that he has in his heart, and that brings him to repentance, and then, you know, he feels awkward about it, and then you know, pretty soon you begin to talk, and then you realize that whatever, you know, hatred was all about was really nonsense, and you reconcile, you see, and then you become friends. And the animosity is gone. And that's why sometimes God allows those kind of circumstances and causes those kind of circumstances to happen, so too can be reconciled by an act of kindness. So, you know, let's think about all these matters when we study the law of God. The depth of it. What is really, that God is aiming at here? You know, he wants his children to be one, not divided, not hateful to each other. And so this kind of circumstances make it possible. And this is what the law is all about also. You know, there's an awful lot of psychology there. When you think about it, that is spiritual psychology, the way God deals with us to create these kind of situations. Verse 6, you shall not rest the judgment of your poor in his cause. Because a lot of people may tend to do it. You know, the judge has a friend, you know, he sees a rich man and he can do him good. You know, the poor cannot do him much good. And so he's going to be in favor of the rich man and not of the poor. God says, don't do it. He's my child, just like the rich one is my child. You see, and that's unrighteousness for a person to do. He says, don't do any of these kind of things. So he's giving them an awful lot of examples what should not be done. And in essence, much of what life is all about is learning about how not to do things. You see? As well as how to do them right, you know, based on the consequences. And so God gives them an awful lot of laws that tells them what not to do, and the consequences if they do it. And also, in contrast, the good things that they should do, and the consequences which are good, for which cause they should do them. So this is what he's saying here. Verse 7, keep you far, far. Don't even, you know, get close to it. Keep far from a false matter. And the more you befriend people that are not right, you know, the rich and others, you know, like that, the more you allow them to, you know, give you a drink, bribe you, whatever it may be, the closer you get to it, and the less you're going to be able to look at it objectively. And sometimes, you know, you have to keep your distance when it comes to judgment from your own friends, you know, from your own parents, or, you know, your own wives, and anybody that you love, you know. That's one of the problems that we have. We get too close when it comes to judgment. It's not we should not get too close. We should. But we get too close when it comes to the time of judgment to our mates, or our friends, or our children, that we take their cause, you see, without even looking into the matter. This is the time to distance ourselves from our family, from our loved ones, and think only about God and His law and His judgment and His righteousness. You see? And that's what happens to all of us to one degree or the other. You know, we all know those examples where there are all these bad things happening and the parents cannot see it because they're too close to their children. Or, you know, the husband cannot see what his wife is doing, or the wife cannot see what her husband is doing, or whatever it may be. They're just too close to them. And so they get that feeling, well, you know, he can do, you know, he's got the kind of a wife that can do no wrong as far as he's concerned. Or a husband, or a child, whatever it may be. And God says, don't do that. You see, we constantly judge by nature. We're all doing it. That's the way we function. And God is educating our minds, our nature. You see, that's how we eat His flesh and drink His blood. That's how Christ is being revealed in us. That's how He lives His life in us. When we take all these words that He gave us, which are spirit and are alive, they're not dead, and we integrate them, and we cause them to allow us to govern our thoughts and feelings and emotions and our actions and reactions. Now let's study the law of God with this in mind. You know, we're just going through it in a sort of a survey, even though we're going through it verse by verse. It's still a survey. You have to go very, very deeply into it, and you can spend hours doing it through every single scripture here. Because there are 1,001 or 1,000,001 ramifications there to every scripture. And even that is not good enough, because who can totally search the mind of God? We can't. And verse 7, again, keep far from a false matter, and the innocent and the righteous slay you not. And that's unfortunately what happens in judgment, and who knows how many people in this country have been put to death when somebody else really did it. So he says, when you do that, regardless of, you know, your innocence, you may really have thought, based on the fact that that person was guilty, God is going to require it from your hands. So we have to be extremely, extremely careful at that. And that's why God gave a law later on, as we read it, and He made it several times. Only by the mouth of two or three witnesses, every matter shall be judged. If you've got only one, even if one person saw somebody murder, God does not accept that as valid. And of course, we don't like that. We think, well, one person saw, that should be good enough. How many do you need? Well, because of the fact that people may have wrong perception, may have heard, you know, the wrong thing, may have seen something that seemed to be as if that person did it, in other words, the appearance, because of those possibilities, and we are not God, you see, now if we're in the position like in ancient Israel, well, if you didn't know, and there was only one witness, well, you went to God. You see, you went to the priest, and the priest asked God. Now you had two witnesses. All three witnesses, all the hosts of the holy angels, you see? So you're not making judgment now, passing judgment now based on one witness. So that's in essence what God is saying here. And later on, you know, as we read this statement, only by the mouth of two or three witnesses shall somebody be put to death, and for that matter, even many other things. And He said, if you do that, I will not justify the wicked. You're going to be responsible for it, and his blood or her blood or whatever may be, and sometimes the blood may be just spiritual, you know, an insult. It could be a false report, you see, and then you kill the person verbally, so to speak, because of a false report, and God says, I'm going to require it from you. So we have to be extremely sober, fearful of God, obedient to the law of God, not relying on our own emotions or feelings or whatever it may be when we pass judgment, even in our own hearts when nobody even knows about it. But God does, and God records those things, and God will hold us responsible for it, as Jesus Christ said, by every word that proceeds out of your mouth. And obviously, He's speaking also by every thought and every intention and every feeling and every emotion, whatever. You know, He's aware of that too. God is going to judge us based on that. And verse 8, and you shall take no gift, in other words, no bribe, for the gift blinds them that have sight, and perverts the words of the righteous. And that's exactly what happens, unfortunately, with a lot of people. They take sides. Why? Well, surely this man is a wise man. He knows. He's got a good reputation. The other one, you know, is a scoundrel and has bad reputation. Why should I believe that one? God says, don't do that. It doesn't make any difference who that person is. Righteousness is righteousness. And even liars sometimes speak the truth. So if you're going to judge them based on the track record that they had, and they were speaking the truth, Where would that put you in the judgment day? You know, you cannot use that. Well, no, that guy was a liar. Everybody knows he's a liar. So what? That makes absolutely no difference to God. Every case should be judged by its own merit. And God wants us to be this kind of judges. Not to take any bribe, because a bribe could be money, it could be a favor, and it could be an opinion. You see? It could be anything. God says, don't do that, because that's going to pervert your words. It's going to blind you to the reality. You see? Only God knows exactly the intent and the heart of every person. We don't have that capacity. And so, all we can do is investigate as much as possible and within every possibility that we have, and fear God, and walk with Him, and ask God when we are not sure to make us understand what is really the situation there so we can pass judgment, because sometimes you really have to. And then when that is done, then God is going to get into the act. But otherwise, have to be extremely careful. Verse 9, it says, and the stranger shall you not oppress. Well, so what is a stranger? You know, he doesn't belong here. He's a legal alien. You know, let's use him, abuse him, you know, give him minimum wages. God says, you better not do that. I'm watching. And that's in essence what God is saying, that you should fear God. A judge should fear God. That's one of the first thing. You know, the fear of God is the beginning of wisdom. When we stop fearing God, then we think, well, he's not watching. He doesn't know what's happening. And we do all those things. And even when we don't do them, if we just think them, as we think, so we are, that's already a reflection of our nature. And for that too, we're going to be judged. And that's why Christ made it very plain. Not only the person who murders is guilty of murder, but the person who even hates. And nobody knows. Nobody may know that that we hate someone. And God knows it. And those of us who fear God, you see, truly fear God, we know all those things, and so we're not playing games. And we know that before God we're naked and we cannot hide anything. You see, and that's how the law of God is being written on our hearts. We don't play games there. So neither by deed or emotion or thoughts or whatever it may be, or attitude, should we do any evil. And God says, don't do that. Don't do that to the stranger. Don't take advantage of him. Don't have this natural. That's what people have. This natural resentment or fear or suspicion of the stranger. Well, he's a stranger. He's different. In other words, immediately we don't like him. That's human nature. And God is planting in us his nature, and he doesn't feel like that. And we should not either. And if we have this problem, we should work on it. Get rid of it. You know, and God is going to purge it from our hearts and minds the hard way if we don't do it the easy way, on our own. And so that's what God says. Verse 9, and the stranger you shall not oppress. For you know, you see, you know the heart of a stranger. Seeing you were strangers in the land of Egypt. Well, what about the people that don't know the heart of strangers because they were not strangers? Well, if they are going to persist in this state of mind, God is going to, you know, give them a taste of their own medicine, and every single one of us is going to get it one way or the other. So we should not be playing games. If we think, I don't know how it feels, well, God is going to make us know how it feels. So before we get to that point, let's just think, you know, as God does. Everybody is His child. And he's not comfortable and he's not happy and he's not going to allow any one of us to get away with it. And he knows all things. That's the way we fear God and obey him, you know, and walk in his commandments and statutes and judgments and love, you know, love God and our friend. And if he's not, we should make him a friend or make her a friend as ourselves. And when we do, well, they become a part of our empirical self, so to speak, and then we love them as we love ourselves. How many of us want to be treated as strangers? With suspicion, you see, being taken advantage of. None of us. Since we don't, if we do not treat others in like manner, we are transgressors of the law. And then we read in verse 10, basically an agricultural law, and 6 years shall you sow your land, like 6 days you work, 6 years you do it to the land, and gather in the increase thereof, but the seventh year, which is a Sabbath, just like you have the weekly Sabbath, you have the sabbatical cycle also for the land, but the seventh year, you shall let it rest and lie fallow. You see, that has different purposes. One is for the land itself. Rejuvenation. Regeneration, you see. And also it has another purpose. And so I said, the seventh year shall lie fallow, that the poor of your people may eat. Whatever is going to grow there, obviously, is going to continue to grow because there are seeds in the ground. You see? And there are trees, and there are plants, and there are crops, and all that. Whether you plant or not, those kind of things are going to continue to grow one way or the other. And so God is planting here something for the poor. You know? The seventh year, the poor man would know that he's going to be able to go to the field, any field that he wants to, and not destroy it, you know, not harvest it in the wrong way, not, you know, break branches, whatever it may be, not cause any damage. But this is a gift from God. So the poor of your people, and the poor of your people, again, are family relatives, because they're the ones that live around you. That the poor of your people may eat, and what they leave, the beast of the field shall eat. So they too are going to eat it. In either case, you don't work in your soil. And in like manner, you shall deal with your vineyard and with your olive yard. And, you know, some people say, oh, what am I going to do in that year? I'm going to eat. Well, God made it a plan in another place that He's going to bless the sixth year so much that it's going to give you plenty for the sixth year, for the seventh year, and for the eighth year. You see, so you're covered for 3 years, and that taught Israel also to live by faith. And it's a law that he can test to this very day. And the people who are in the farming in business, you see, they really trust in God, wait on God, fear God, walk with God. God is going to make sure that they're going to have plenty the sixth year, because God is the same and He does not change. And what He did for Israel, He would have done today too, no matter where you are on any you know, little plot of land on planet Earth. God is the God of the whole earth. You see, that's what God says, you know, put me to the test. Prove me whether I'll do these things for you or not. And so, this is what He told them. Don't do it. You know, let the poor, let the, you know, the animals eat it, but you don't go and work in your field. Doesn't mean that you cannot go there and, you know, pluck a plum or a fruit or whatever it may be yourself. But realize, you know, let them have it first. As it is on the sixth year, you got all that you want. What do you need more than that? And so He says, in like manner you shall deal with your vineyard, you know, everything that you own. Verse 12, 6 days you shall do your work, and you put the two together, you know, the 6 days of the week and the 6 years, and the sabbatical concept in both cases. And as a matter of fact, in Israel, this year is a sabbatical, and you find something there that the secular Jews don't like, don't appreciate. The Jews, the religious Jews, would not buy, would not go to any store in Israel proper. You see, the land of Israel itself, that is under the Israeli control, and would not go to any of the stores, supermarkets, a vegetable store, whatever it may be, and buy fruit from there. They go to the Arabs, to the Palestinians, and buy it from there. And the reason is because of this law. They're not allowed on the seventh year to eat of the fruit. Obviously, today everything is upside down, so administrative decisions have to be made based on that. After all, the majority of people don't have lands. You see, they live in the cities, and so they don't work in those fields. And on the other hand, also, the Palestinians also live in the land of Israel. One way or the other. Well, anyway, that's a different matter. But this is what God is saying here, and these people, in their own understanding of the law, try to abide by it. So God says, 6 years you shall do your work, and on the seventh day you shall rest, that your ox and your ass may rest, and that the son of your handmaid... Why does it say the son of your handmaid? Why not your handmaid? Because your handmaid is working in the house, so to speak, fixing food, sewing, things like that. But the sons of the slaves, or the handmaidens, were put to work. And that's why he's phrasing it in this manner. That the son of your handmaid and the stranger may be refreshed. You know, and the strangers were used to do work for the people who could afford them. And in all the things that I have said unto you, take you heed and make no mention all the names of other Elohim, neither let it be heard out of your mouth. In other words, all the name, you know, the people that lived in the land, the Canaanites, who were idol worshippers, and some of them are still there. And he said, you don't follow their example. You don't begin to be idol worshippers. You know, build yourself or create yourself. You know, the god of fertility and the god of farming, the god of this and the god of that. He says, don't do that. Don't even, you know, have it in your mouth. Stay away from it as far as you can, because I am the only true God and the others are not, and they cannot do anything for you to begin with. Verse 14, 3 times you shall keep a feast, and the word here, feast in Hebrew is hag, and hag basically means, well actually the word in Hebrew when it says 3 times is regalim. 3. In other words, the word for feast here in Hebrew is regalim. Regalim comes from the word regal, and regal means foot. And you walk on your feet, you see. And so when they went to Jerusalem or Shiloh, they walked over there, and that was called pilgrimage. So in essence, in our correct translation, an exact translation will be three pilgrimages. You see, not three feasts. You see, three pilgrimages. Because that was the intent. You walk, you see, to a place that God is going to set His name there. And so God didn't call it a feast, He called it a pilgrimage. In this case here, so it says three pilgrimages, you shall celebrate the Hag, you see. And the word Hag means a feast. That is general translation to English. But what does it mean, the word Hag itself? It comes from the verb Lahog, which means to circle. And when they came before God, they basically sat in circle around Him. Just like you sit in circle around the fire. You see? So that, you know, those words have meanings. They're not just empty words, you know, like feast. You know, what does it mean, feast? We think, you know, to feast means, you know, to have a party, things like that. But in Hebrew, they have special meanings, and God used those words. And it's not in vain that He's using these words. They convey exactly what He wants. The three feasts, He didn't call it feasts, but regalim, pilgrimages, because He wanted them to make a pilgrimage. You know, the Arabs call it the Hajj, when they go to Mecca, a pilgrimage. And this is what God is saying. Three pilgrimages, you are going to come and encircle, you know, encircle the tabernacle, encircle the temple before Me. So it's a very descriptive explanation here of what it is. And then it says Hag HaMatzot, which is, you know, the feast, or it means encircling, you see, of the Feast of Unleavened Bread. You shall keep 7 days, you shall eat, you see, it's 7 days. Just like we mentioned earlier, some people say, well, whenever you eat unleavened bread in the Passover, since you cannot eat leaven, you eat it whenever you want to. No, God says, no, it doesn't work like that. He told us 7 days. He wants us to eat it 7 days. Not four, not five, not three, not two. You see? And it's not whenever, and we do not interpret that. You know, we have our own problems, just like in the days of old, like the rabbis, they began to interpret the law. God does not want His law interpreted, you see, according to our own understanding, but according to His own understanding. And when He said seven, He meant seven. That's the simplicity in Christ. And God says, you know, through Moses, this is the law. Don't add to it. Don't diminish. In other words, don't come up with your own interpretations. And many in our midst have done just that and deceived the brethren. And the guilt of that sin will be on their head. And also on the ones who have done it, even though in ignorance, only their punishment is not going to be as great as those who deceived them. So we all have to be careful. And to begin with, it's our responsibility to check on everything that we hear and we see. And not take it for granted that because He's a teacher, He knows. I may be, you know, giving you some false information here and there. You see, you have to check on that. Because I'm not perfect. You know, I'm not God. I'm not an angel. I'm not a prophet. I'm not Moses. You see? Hopefully, I have a good measure of knowledge and understanding of the law. But even then, man should never put his trust in man, but in God Himself. So the responsibility is still ours. And at least, you know, by warning you, you know, don't take every word that comes out of my mouth for granted. You see? At least, you know, you cannot say, well, He told me that. And now let's be fearful about the law of God and obey the laws of God. What God says, prove all things. So let's not take anything for granted. And that's basically what it is. And obviously, you know, most of us who may say something that may not be necessarily correct, and later on we find out, no, it was not correct, and we change that, we don't do it maliciously, we do it sincerely. But even us, you know, that's why, you know, James would say, do not be many masters, because we are going to receive the greater damnation. You see? But on the other hand, we have to let everybody know also, if we're honest, look, I'm just a man. I may make mistakes. You know, I cannot claim, well, the Lord said that to me. He didn't say that to me. You see? I don't have a greater advantage than you do. I have the same role that you do. You see? So we're all responsible. We must all prove all things. Never take any man's word, no matter how wise that person is. That's just like the law that we read earlier about the bribes. You see? Don't take it from anybody. And, you know, we have to be careful about that. That's why we should prove all things and study the Word of God day and night. You know? And then, you know, we're all covered, so to speak, in that sense. And if we have done something wrong, well, God knows our heart. We know that, you know, it was not a willful one. It's not negligence, reckless, unwillingness to study the law of God, unwillingness, you know, to listen to others who may know a little bit better. You see, and sometimes even the babes can tell us, the teacher, something that we don't know and understand. We should always be open, regardless of who's speaking. You see? And this way, this is what God is looking for. He's not looking for perfection in us. And He certainly is not looking for perfection in the teachers. You see, we're not gods. We don't know everything. We're not Moses. But at least He's demanding and commanding us to study the law day and night, so that what comes out of our mouth, as much as it is possible within our being, you see, in efforts to be right and in the fear of God. And that's all we can do. So we don't need to worry about that, you know, beyond that. You know, if we make some mistakes, well, God knows our heart. And anyway, it's important for all of us to be fully aware of that. Because, you know, as God said through Jeremiah, cursed be the man that puts his trust in man. Never put your trust in any man and never think, well, you know, he said that, that's good enough for me. We're going to be guilty and pay the penalty for it in the day of judgment, you see. And the masters are going to pay, you know, the penalty, but, you know, they've done it with the sincerity of their heart. They tried, they studied, they, you know, they did everything they could. Well, God is not going to be harsh on us. But He will be if we're reckless. We just, you know, speak without even thinking, studying, you know, look in the background, context, whatever it may be. That's when God is going to be a little bit more severe with us. So let's apply it to every single one of us, great and small. Doesn't make any difference to God. Let's see in verse 16 again. The Feast of Harvest. Well, actually, in verse 15, we went a little bit too far. The Feast of Unleavened Bread, you shall keep again 7 days. So it's seven, not six, not five. God said seven. That's all there is to it. You shall eat unleavened bread as I commanded you. Who commanded us to eat 7 days? God. And yet many of us have heard it. I've heard it from supposed, you know, great and mighty and high, you know, making that statement. No, you don't have to eat 7 days. You know, God didn't mean that. You know, it's just when you eat, make sure that it is unleavened bread. So it could be only 1 day because you hate it. You know, you don't like unleavened bread. God made it very plain. I commanded you. These are His words. These are not the words of men. You see? We've got to be on the safe side. God said it. We do it. We don't, you know, interpret the mind of God to feed our own understanding and our own feelings and emotions, whatever it may be. Now, that's exactly what the false prophets have done. Be it the rabbis, God calls them false prophets, if what they say was not right. And every single one of us, when we utter something that is not in accordance with the law of God, in that point we become false prophets. And I've been many times false prophets too, and every single one of us are, to one degree or the other, when what we say was not necessarily correct. And then we keep studying and realize, no, that's not what it means. You see, and then we go back and repent of that and we correct the matter and we tell others, well, oops, you know, that was a mistake. And, you know, as I do now and then, when I listen to the tape, I realize, no, I said certain things that were not correct. I didn't mean them that way. You see? Well, you know, that's not a problem with God. God understands that. You know, that's our own limitation, being finite being. But He does not take it lightly, you see, and lightly that is when false prophets, arrogant, proud, do not fear God, lean to their own understanding, interpret the Word of God in contrast to what He said, you see, and teach others likewise. The judgment and the condemnation will be greater on such people. You see? So let's take heed and take warning to every single one of us, as Christ would say, he that has an ear, let him hear. You see? And after all, even the apostles themselves, you know, made a huge mistake in the sense that they thought that Christ was coming in their day and began to preach that, you know, with strength and power and the conviction and all that, and they deceived the people of God to believe He was coming in their day. And a lot of people in their weakness, not proving all things, not listening to the words of God as they should, or the words of Jesus Christ, who never said that He is coming in their day. You see, He didn't say about John that, you know, He's coming in his day, in his lifetime. They thought this is what He said. He didn't say that. That's what John was later on correcting at the end of the century. And he never said that. They thought that this is what it was because they wanted to think what they wanted to think. You see? And so they deceived. Here it is, the apostles, including Paul, constantly saying, well, He's coming in our day, He's coming in our day, and don't get married, and don't do this, and don't do that. And nothing happened, and people gave up the faith. And God is going to hold the apostles responsible for it. You see? Because if God didn't say that, they had no business telling everybody else. And God allowed it to happen that way, didn't correct it, caused it to be recorded for generations to come for 2,000 years. And you can imagine some of the apostles toward the end of their life realized their mistake and probably apologized for it, but then it was too late for some who already gave up the faith. You see? And that's why God says, you know, you better be careful. Every word that proceeds out of your mouth is going to judge you. This is what's going to be our judge ultimately, and that's exactly what Christ said. I'm not going to judge you. The word, you see, is going to judge you. You see? So whatever word proceeds out of our mouth, let's be careful about it. And always go to God and then ask, you know, are we wrong on this matter or this matter? Please open our eyes. As David would say, you know, deliver me from presumptuous sins. And all of us should take heed of that. Anyway, God is saying here in verse 16, speaking about actually verse 15 again, the last part of it, eat unleavened bread 7 days, because I commanded you at the time appointed the month of Aviv. Aviv means also spring. You know, there is Tel Aviv in Israel, Spring Hill. And that came from an actual place that was in Babylon when Ezekiel was in the captivity there. He basically says that he went to the captives there after God spoke to him that were in Tel Aviv, you know, in Spring Hill. And so they call that city there Spring Hill in Israel, because it was sand before that. There was nothing there. And then it became Spring Hill. Lots of flowers and plants and trees and homes and houses. And so in the month of the spring, he said, this is what you do it, for in it you came out from Egypt, and none shall appear before me empty. You see, that's what God says. What he meant by that, he explained it very plainly. The people of Israel were to bring offerings, sacrifices, whatever it may be, and bring it to God. You see, and certain sacrifices, only God received it. You see, because they were completely destroyed when they were sacrificed. And only God was the recipient of it. Just like you find in the pagan religions to this very day. You know, they offer food and grain and things like that to their gods, to their idols. And nobody else, the priests don't eat it, nobody else eats it. You know, the only ones that may eat it are the rats, you know, and the mice and things like that. But no human being was to consume of that which is offered to the gods. Now that's what God meant. When an offering is given to God that is meant to be only as a burnt offering, only to God, only God receives it. And you see how people perverted that to say, well, you know, when you come before God, you know, during the feast, well, you bring an offering and we collect it and we put it in the bank and we use it in our own needs, our own interests, our own selfish desires, and, you know, for the work too. That's not what God says. He says, when you bring it before me, it means only before me, no one else. The priest couldn't touch it. Now, there were other things that they would bring it before God to the temple, and both the priest and the people who offered it could eat also of it. So we have to distinguish between one and the other, and later on in Leviticus, when we come to the point of the sacrifices, God makes it very plain. Which offerings are given only to God, and no one else takes it, and which offerings are to be shared between the priest and the people of Israel, and yet certain parts of that animal still had to be offered only to God, and nobody else could touch it, like the fat, you know, they had to burn it. Nobody else could eat it. They were not allowed. And the inside, you know, parts of the animal that also were burned. And the skin that was burned. Nobody else, you know, could take it and use it for themselves, you know. Some would say, well, this is a nice piece of fur, and I want to make something out of it. You couldn't do that. Only God could receive it. So let's understand what he's talking about here. You do not appear before me, not before the priest, not before the work. You know, not before this and that and the other thing, but before me, empty, because I'm the one to receive it, period. Nobody else in between. And verse 16, and the feast of harvest, the first fruits of your labors, which you sow in the field, and the feast of ingathering at the end of the year, when you gather in your labors out of the field. So this agricultural, seasonal holidays that God gave Israel. And they were going to gather, you know, all these things and bring it before God and circle, you know, before the tabernacle, before the altar. And that's why it's called a hag, feast, in English, you know, translated to feast. But let's understand what it really means and why it was called, why God gave it that name. They did not invent, you know, Israel did not invent these names. Moses didn't. God did. And it had to have a special meaning. That's what he meant. You come before me in a circle, you know, like little children around their parent. And verse 18, you shall not offer the blood of my sacrifice with the leavened bread, because I had to pour the blood. You see? And nobody could say, like, you know, they would say in countries where they drink blood, you know, they freeze it and they make a blood pudding or things like that. God says, you cannot do it. You pour it to the ground, not even God would receive it. So he says, you shall not offer the blood of my sacrifice with leavened bread, neither shall the fat of my feast remain all night until the morning. Well, because it, you know, it corrupts and begins to stink and breeds worms and things like that. So in other words, you bring that before God and you burn it and it's gone. That's it. That's how it remains holy and not defiled and profane. Verse 19, the choicest first fruits of your land you shall bring into the house of the Lord your God. Well, anyway, we're going to stop at this point and continue next time. This is again Mordecai Joseph. Greetings to all of God's people.